So yeah, we better get started. We'll be here till it gets dark.
Yeah, I know.
But welcome everybody to episode 109 of Scary Dad Podcast. It is the 12th of November, so we're just a couple weeks away from Turkey Day. So start brining those bitches and start making your deviled eggs and stuff like that, because you know you're going to eat them all before they get served. You'll have to make another batch.
I got to fry a turkey this year, man. I haven't done that in a while, but somebody remembered how good my fried turkey was, so I've been asked to do it again.
Fried turkeys are the good stuff. Especially if you put
them in there. Well, when I used to do catering, I used to sell them for Thanksgiving and Christmas. And I'd have four fryers going and just all morning long just frying turkeys for people.
I was going to say, like, if you get one of those, like, somebody does the traditional and somebody else does a fried and you get a little bit of both, you can
kind of... Yeah, that's what we usually do.
All right, this will be the second of... I doubt we'll be able to get all of this into two parts. So it might be a three-part series.
Okay.
Of 1987, because this really was the mother of all years whenever it comes to pop culture, and we need to give it its due respect. We can't just skip over stuff. Last week's episode was pretty freaking long.
It was a good year for me too in general, because that's the year I turned 14. When I turned 14, that's a lot of things happened in my life as far as just becoming the person I am now. Mm-hmm. And making mistakes, that kind of, that you learn from. And I started smoking that that year. Just every, when I was 14, all of a sudden I lost my mind.
Oh, you know, it's a good year. I like 14. I liked. I didn't realize living in 1987 how special it was, though. So we're not gonna tarry long. We'll let Mr. Gomez introduce the segment.
First, the old business.
Okay, on this date in 1793, Jean-Sylvain Bailly, the first mayor of Paris. Guillotined. Shump. I didn't click on the link to see what he did, but whatever it was.
It was bad enough to get him killed.
Yeah. Okay, on this date in 1927, Leon Trotsky was expelled from the Soviet Communist Party, leaving Stalin undisputed control of the nation. So that was nice.
Mm-hmm.
Something straight out of G.I. Joe right here. On this date in 1941, the temperatures dropped to negative 12 degrees Celsius around Moscow. The Soviets launched ski troops against the freezing German forces that surrounded the city.
The ski troops just sound so dangerous. Little laser-tipped skis.
All right. Notable births on this date in 1934. Charlie Manson was born. 1970, Tanya Harding.
You saw the recent documentary they did about Manson on Fox, if not mistaken. It was probably, I happened to catch it, I was at home. It was last month, I believe. It was a really good documentary.
Really?
It just went through everything. Yeah, it was pretty, they had a bunch of interviews with former members of his family, I guess you could say it. And yeah, it's pretty good, man. You ought to, if them, they're probably going to air it again, I would say. So keep an eye out for it.
1970, Tanya Harding. She's the kneecapper at the Olympics.
Yeah, well, her husband was. Her fiancé. And she also had the sex tape.
Yeah.
She had one of the original, one of the first sex tapes.
She was one of the first ones with sex tape. It got leaked.
Yeah. People forgot her about her is what it was. She had to get back in the news.
Mm. All right, and this date in 2003, we lost actor Jonathan Brandis, most famous for playing Bill in the original It TV series. And in 2007, we lost Ira Levin, who wrote Rosemary's Baby. So, a few horror icons there in the old business. And it's a short old business, so we'll let you out of it instead of rambling on for an hour, so we can get into the 1987. So we'll cut out now, and we'll see you shortly.
Don't hate me because I'm beautiful. This is my hair in the morning. So I wash it, just like you, and blow it dry, just like you. So how come my hair looks great despite all this? I discovered Pantene.
Pantene's Pro-Vitamin B5 Complex penetrates your hair to give it inner strength, so it's healthier, stronger.
And it's always beautiful, just like mine.
Pantene Shampoos and Conditioners, serious care for beautiful hair.
All right, hope you enjoyed that break.
We're back into it.
New business is new business, and this is new business.
Okay, have you recently heard the Nebraska Tourism Bureau, which there is such a thing, just so you know. You wouldn't expect Nebraska to have a huge
look at all that grass.
They've come up with a new slogan that's going to be on signs and shit. And this is not made up. They actually came out with this. The new slogan for Nebraska, the Nebraska Tourism Bureau, is honestly, it's not for everyone. They just said, screw it. We're not going to lie to anybody. You know, it's not for everyone.
Some people just don't like corn.
So they put out a statement. We discovered that we can't offer something to everyone, but to those that we can, this campaign speaks to their sense of adventure in discovering what we as Nebraskans are all about. Nebraska's old tagline, which the state stopped using in 2015, was Nebraska Nice. And they decided to go ahead and say, screw it. Look, if you want to come. We might not have something for you.
We're not necessarily nice. There's probably some assholes around.
Did you know, I didn't even know this, but you know they're currently filming a new Rambo movie?
Yes.
With Sly Stallone, called Rambo Last Blood, which I thought was interesting. Just this little tidbit I wanted to throw out there. I did not know they were coming with one. Synopsis is, in the fifth episode of the franchise, when the daughter of one of his friends is kidnapped, Rambo, who has been working on a ranch, crosses the U.S.-Mexico border and quickly finds himself up against the full might of one of Mexico's most violent cartels. So he's taking on the Mexican drug cartels this time.
Oh, damn.
Very exciting. Co-written by Sly Stallone himself. A little interesting tidbit that I found out during a recent interview, Robert Englund. You know, he's been in the business for a long time. And in 1978, he wasn't yet a horror icon. But interestingly enough, in a recent interview with Access Live, he one thing he said is that he may have one more Elm Street left in him if the opportunity arises. But he also relayed a story how he helped turn the city of Pasadena, California, into Haddonfield. He had a roommate back when they did the original Halloween, and he conned me into going to Pasadena one day with garbage bags full of dead leaves. And he was one of the guys that helped decorate the set with dead leaves to make it look like fall. I thought that was interesting. He actually worked on the set of the original Halloween movie.
That's killer. There's a thing that came out recently on Tumblr or whatever, and it showed a picture of, it was like Jamie Lee Curtis and the kids she was babysitting. And she's holding the pumpkin. And it's a split photo that shows that the intro credit pumpkin and the one she's holding is the same pumpkin with a slightly different carve on it. And because they were filming it in the summer in Los Angeles, it was hard to come by pumpkins, and they only had one. So they use it for everything.
Oh, cool. That is very cool. Okay. Have you ever been to the symphony?
Yes.
A lot of people take symphony very seriously. When stuff, you only clap at certain times, you know, you don't, it's silence. You want to enjoy the music. But recently, a symphony, Gustav Mahler's Fifth Symphony, was being played, and this woman decided, this was in Latvia, no, not Latvia, it was the Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra.
Just Latvia.
Okay.
Nobody knows where it is anyway.
So this woman decided that she wanted to go ahead and grab a piece of gum out of a bag in the middle of the show. So the rustling of the paper apparently started getting a lot of people upset with him. So a young man sitting next to the lady, he finally lost his patience with this woman trying to get gum out of the bag, snatched the bag and threw it on the floor. So she got pissed off, but she sat back for a while and waited. As the concert got to the final notes, she turned to a neighbor, said something, turned to the guy, and began slapping him in the face in the middle of the symphony. And this huge brawl broke out when the woman's male companion also jumped in and started beating the gum thrower up in the middle of the symphony. So can you imagine everybody's quiet? This woman starts trying to get some, rustling a bag, trying to get gum. It starts a riot in the symphony. That's just an awesome scene to imagine.
That's awesome.
A little bit of political correctness gone awry, as we see so many examples of nowadays. Kleenex, currently, you can buy, well, not anymore. You can buy what's called man-sized tissues, which are Kleenex that are extra large. They're having to change the name to Kleenex Extra Large, Kleenex XL, because people have said, you know,
it's sexist.
It's sexist to call those man-sized when a woman can use them also.
I do find it funny when companies try to get woke, and so then they like they take the same product and just make it pink and then charge more because it's for women.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, that's acceptable in our backwards thinking society. It's like, ooh, I got an idea. Let's just like charge more for it. It's not that it's pink. Like, I understand. It's like you can have an entire like rainbow of different available colors. Right. And you know you'll have demographics that want the green ones or the blue ones or the pink ones or whatever, but to take a razor, paint it pink, slap four women on the box, and then just charge like
a dollar extra,
and then have that be a successful product. What does it say? It's not saying about the company. The company knows what they're doing.
It's saying about society.
People are dumb.
Okay, you mentioned Haunting of Hill House a little while ago. I still haven't gotten into it yet, but everything I see just seems incredible about the show. I've seen nothing but good things about it.
Obsessed.
Recent article that I read, though, just you'll appreciate this. Mike Flanagan, creator and writer of Haunting of Hill House, says that if it gets renewed, expect a totally new story arc next season. As he puts it, the story of the Crane family is done. It ended the way they wanted it ended. Don't expect, and the article uses this as an example, but don't expect a Walking Dead type thing where we drag on the same story arc forever, and it looks like it's never going to end.
Mm-hmm.
The next season, and I'm sure it will get renewed, like I said, response to it by the public has been tremendous. So he says it may turn into an anthology series, it may not, it may still center around the house, but the Crane family will be released from what they're going through.
That's good. I haven't made it to the end. I'm still in the middle of this series.
They said that it ended just the way they wanted it to end.
I'm creeping towards the end. After you leave, I'll be hitting episode 7 out of 10. So I'm creeping towards the end. It's really everything. It's everything you want in a scary movie. It's everything you want in a drama series, especially if you like scary stuff.
Yeah.
It is kind of like all of the characters are perfectly well rendered as both children and adults. It's not 100% about the house. It's about their personalities, and it's about how they deal with things.
Mm-hmm.
Again, without giving any spoilers or anything, but you know, some of them don't even see the ghosts, and some of them see the ghosts a lot. And so the ones who don't necessarily believe the ones that do, and you amplify that trauma, or not that trauma, but just kind of amplify that inability to see eye to eye over time, and it leads to some serious interesting conversations. And it's it's funny, it's sad, it's freaking scary, which is what it, you know, when you watch a horror thing, you want it to be. It's scary, it's terrifying. It really is. It's got moments that are scarier than any horror movie I've ever seen.
Okay. Now, I'm looking forward to checking it out. I've heard nothing but good things about it.
It's great. But I don't know how much further, even though I'm still a couple episodes back, I don't know how much further they could go or how much more that family could take. So,
okay. Have you ever been so drunk that you just had no idea what you were doing? I know I have. Have you, while in that state, ever done something to cost you a multi-million dollar job?
No.
Okay. Let's go over to Denver, Colorado. Chad Kelly, 24-year-old backup quarterback for the Denver Broncos. This woman sitting in her house with her child, watching TV late one Saturday night. Some dude walks in, dressed up like a cowboy. Slacks, white long sleeve shirt, vest, red scarf tied around the neck. Walks in and just sits down on the couch, talking to himself, mumbling. Okay, so woman proceeds to scream for help. Her boyfriend or whatever comes in, grabs a plastic vacuum cleaner attachment and begins to beat the shit out of the guy to get him out of the house. Apparently, 24-year-old backup quarterback Chad Kelly was at the Halloween party, players only, at Von Miller's house, linebacker for the Denver Broncos, who was right next door, and went back to the wrong house, sat there, and he has been fired from his job with the Denver Broncos.
Wow.
Yes. Because as a direct result of this incident.
It's cost some people their lives.
Yeah.
Going to the wrong house. That's what happened to Robert Downey Jr. When he got all wasted.
Yeah.
And he broke into a house and fell asleep, you know. Yeah, that's shitty. But I remember it was probably National Enquirer or something showed a picture of the townhouses, and they looked identical to one another, and he was wasted. So he got home, his key didn't work. He's like, oh, popped the window open, crawled in, hit the couch, passed out, woke up the next day, arrested. Boy, that sucks.
Yeah, so Mr. Chad Kelly is no longer a Denver Bronco because he got absolutely shit-faced, wasted, and walked into someone's house dressed up as a cowboy. That's my favorite part. Who dresses up as a cowboy for Halloween nowadays?
You think
it was
like a ghost or something.
Yes, but he was the last person drafted in the NFL draft in 2017, making him what they call Mr. Irrelevant because of so many off-the-field issues he had while he was in college. And apparently it's just carried on, and the Broncos took this as an opportunity to go ahead and just release him and shit can him. So, yeah, that was I found that an interesting piece of news. But that's what I got for today. We can take a break.
All right, let's do it.
It's time you stepped up to a Potemkin Cadillac. It really does cost less than you think. 1987 coupe, $17,543. Sedan, $17,825. Brougham sedan, $18,630. Cimarron, $12,972. These 1987 intro prices won't last long. Come in now and save on the luxurious 87 Potemkin Cadillac of your choice.
Make your mouth so very happy.
Oh, so happy. And we're back.
Yeah.
And we're going to try to do 1987. We're going to try to do it right. We're going to talk about a lot of this stuff. Now, because last time we really went off on a rant, right? It was a good rant, but it was a rant nonetheless. We talked a lot about a lot of stuff, and there's a lot of stuff to talk about on these lists. So rather than jump back and forth like we did last time, we're going to knock off... We're gonna knock off a couple of lists.
Okay.
So the shortest one we've got, is books.
Okay.
So these were books that came out in 1987. Excuse me. Dean Koontz's Watchers. He had other books before. That was the one that really kind of put him on the map. The first Calvin and Hobbes collection.
I love Calvin and Hobbes. That was... groundbreaking, and funnies for the funny pages.
It was brilliant, and he's probably one of the most ethical artists. You know, he wouldn't take licensing.
Yeah.
He didn't want to cheapen it. Millions and millions and millions of dollars in Calvin and Hobbes merchandising. He just, nope, I'm true to my art. And then whenever it was time to quit, he quit.
What's funny is if you're not familiar with Calvin and Hobbes, you've probably seen the sticker of the little boy pissing on a Chevy emblem or a Ford emblem or whatever. That's Calvin.
Yep. And that is not licensed. Bill Watterson saw nothing from any of that, except a lot of grief for not licensing his product.
I actually saw an iteration of that this past weekend of Donald Trump pissing on something. It was like pissing like the CNN logo or something like that. So,
speaking of... Art of the Deal by Donald Trump came out in 1987. So the book that's now again or has been on the bestseller list because of his presidential run and everything. Yep, that book was first published in 1987.
I've been rewatching a lot of Cheap Seats, like you know. They talk about Donald Trump all the time on there. And the most recent one I saw is somebody won a trophy. I can't remember what it was. And they go, "I haven't seen a trophy that tall since Donald Trump's third wife." And I'm like, "That's the First Lady." They're talking about the First Lady of the United States right now. She's a trophy wife.
Oh, yeah. To be fair, he's kind of a trophy husband.
Yeah. He's a sugar daddy for sure.
He's a sugar daddy. They made a successful run. And now she's basically queen.
I'm so ready for this political cycle to be over as far as this election. I'm so sick of just everything.
Midterms or all of the above?
All of the above.
It never ends, dude.
What kills me is social media has made it so much worse than it used to be. It never stops.
It does never stop.
You can't get away from it.
You know, I use that like hide and block button quite a bit. I make sure that I don't see nothing but freaking Godzilla. It's like, if you're not posting about Godzilla, I ain't seeing your shit.
Well, I used to have to just not talk about politics in front of family, just to avoid arguments. Now it's you can't get away from it.
And even if you're quiet, then that makes you somehow worse.
Yeah.
So, oh, well,
both sides hate you.
Yeah. Well, 1987, the first Where's Waldo came out, too.
I never got too much into Where's Waldo, but it was a huge thing.
It was a huge thing, and it's still around.
So yeah.
1987.
What's the next short list we got to get through?
Let's talk about television.
Which was a big part of our childhood, because I don't know about you, but I was a latchkey kid. Mm. So I'd get home, and it was me, the TV, and homework. So I watched a lot of TV.
And there's a lot of stuff that had gone into syndication, but, you know, there's like those 80s. You know, we said last week, that in 1987, these shows were still on TV. They didn't debut. They were in their final season. But A Love Boat, Silver Spoons, The A-Team, Fraggle Rock, Amazing Stories, Remington Steele, Airwolf, and Transformers were still in their regular rotation slots. They hadn't been canceled yet. They hadn't gone into syndication. These were still showing new episodes. They were in their final season. Again, we mentioned it last week, but just kind of running down the line here. Unsolved Mysteries, first year. Remember Max Headroom, first year. Married with Children, the Tracy Ullman Show, which means that The Simpsons debuted then. 21 Jump Street. It's where Johnny Depp got his stuff. Yeah. Actually, Johnny Depp got his start in Nightmare
on Elm Street, yeah.
But this was his first recurring role.
I like the Nightmare on Elm Street, just segue, shout out to Texas Frightmare Weekend. They're setting up a huge... But they're doing Nightmare on Elm Street Part 4 reunion, which is all right.
They've got some... I thought they had some...
Well, they have people that transcend a couple of other ones, too.
Okay.
But it's primarily Part 4 is what they're showing so far. But you know they're going to announce Robert Englund, which is...
Eventually.
Yeah.
Full House. So Uncle Jesse and the Olsen Twins.
John Stamos' leg.
That's it. A Different World. The Cosby spinoff.
Yeah.
Remember the Vietnam show Tour of Duty?
Yes.
That's the one that had the Rolling Stones song, the Paint It Black as a theme song. Beauty and the Beast. A not very well-known show, but it was a...
It was a live-action version of Beauty.
It was a vehicle for Linda Hamilton from Terminator. And it's also where Ron Perlman got his start.
You made an awesome beast, by the way.
Star Trek The Next Generation came out in 87. Friday the 13th, the series came out in 87. The Nickelodeon game show Remote Control. Remote Control was MTV?
MTV, yeah.
Finally, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
TMNT.
Made their small screen debut in 1987. So alongside all these other shows that were still on, these all just came out. I don't think Ninja Turtles really hit it big in like pop culture zeitgeist until like 89, 90, something like that. They were on, but like they really took off when I was like maybe a freshman in high school.
And you know, I don't know if it was like this when you were young, but when I was young, we had one TV in the house. So we watched TV as a family. Everybody watched the same shit. So a lot of these shows, man, were just, they're near and dear to my heart because it was, we'd spend time together watching TV after we'd eat dinner and stuff like that. Or we had TV trays and eat while we were watching TV.
We had two TVs in the house. We had the big TV, which was a 20-inch color. It was a 20-inch color TV. It was just a standalone 20-inch color TV. That sat on a, I think it sat on an old console that didn't work anymore.
Everybody had that at one point or another.
It didn't have a remote control. Well, it did have a remote control. The other one was an old, like, 13-inch black and white that was in my parents' room that had a coat hanger stuck in for the antenna, and it was a flip knob, tack. And it was UHF and VHF, so you could run the channels on one band and
switch it over
and then run the band. And that's where I used to watch, you know,
Saturday morning cartoons
or you know, the after school specials type stuff, you know, after school cartoons or Sesame Street and stuff like that. But yeah,
TV used to be so different, man. I remember in the fifth grade, my mom worked for Woolco. Remember Woolco? And Woolco went out of business in our hometown. They had huge clearance sales and shit, trying to get rid of merchandise. And one of the things I was able to acquire was, it was a little portable TV that had like a 5-inch screen. But it took like 16 D batteries to watch anything on the damn thing. And I remember in the fifth grade, I decided I was going to run away. So I packed up my He-Man, my Shockwave Soundwave Transformer, and that damn big ass TV. And I hit the road, dude. And I was sick and tired. My mom was like, go. I'll see you later. And I made the block and came back home. But yeah, I made sure to take my TV with me, dude. I was going to be able to watch my Saturday morning cartoons as long as my batteries held out. That thing was so heavy, dude.
Oh, yeah.
It was a little 5-inch screen, but the thing was 20 inches wide.
Yeah, those things were battery chunkers. Oh, man.
The good old days.
Very much the good old days.
Console televisions, dude. 20-inch screen and a 40-inch cabinet.
Liquor cabinet, record player. the whole works.
Oh, console stereos are ridiculous, dude. They just had little speakers in them, but the things were huge. It was a piece of furniture.
So, I remember... I'm mentioned it on the show, like in the small town. My memory is correct. The intervals probably aren't. So in my mind, it was forever before our local TV showed like He-Man and Transformers on regular TV. If you wanted to watch Transformers, you had to wake up at like 5 a.m. and on channel 9. You could see like one clip of Transformers as a segment of the Bozo show. Remember the Bozo the Clown show?
Yeah.
So you'd be like, "We'll be right back. Watch this cartoon, kids," and be like, "Dun dun dun," like. But that was what I got of Transformers, and then whenever Transformers actually came on TV, then it was awesome. But I did, you know, it seemed like forever. That I'd been watching it, you know. My dad used to get up on Saturday morning and be like, "What are you doing up? It was so early." I'm like, come down to my, you know, come up to my grandmother's house and sit there and like try to binge watch He-Man. I get so pissed if a baseball game was on or something because it's like 3 a.m. He-Man. Like, ah, but. That's the way TV used to work. There was no on-demand. If shit wasn't
on, you had to wait for it to come on.
If your nap ran long, you had to wait till tomorrow. Yeah. I guess. All right. You say, you know, we were going through some changes in 1987. Here's some changes that really, you know, whenever it came to music. Because that was kind of right around the time. It was probably at the height. But maybe not at the height. Maybe it was like right on the downhill slope of the Satanic Panic. Right?
Yeah.
Because all of your hair metal bands, your Wasp and Judas Priest and all that had been around for a while and kind of were I don't want to say fading, but they were not
as popular as they had.
But rather than talking about fairy castles and druids and stuff, You had guys like Anthrax with a song called I'm the Man. You remember that song?
Mm-hmm.
There was the censored version, and then there was the uncensored version. And man, that was a thing. That was a sight to behold. If you knew somebody who had that uncensored version of I'm the Man, it was like a 2.5 minute song. It wasn't very long. But that shot you right into adulthood real fast.
Another band that should have been big this year, and I'm not sure if it's... I'm not looking at the list, but just remembering, because I remember being in ninth grade. I was 14 years old, and Bon Jovi had come to play in the nearest large town. And this girl that I knew had went to the concert, and she came back with a vest, a denim vest, with the logo of Guns N' Roses on the back, because GNR had opened for Bon Jovi on that tour in 1987. That changed. That was one of the bands that changed the face of rock.
Appetite for Destruction came out in 87.
And I remember they were on tour opening for Bon Jovi that year. And she had apparently gone back, 14 years old, had gone backstage with the members, ended up hooking up with Guns N' Roses.
Wow.
I'm not sure who she hooked up with them, but she claimed that that's what went down. But yeah, I remember Guns N' Roses, they popped up that year, and they got away from that hair metal shit for sure.
Yeah, they were like the gap between hair metal. Like,
yeah,
they represented,
because they were opening for Bon Jovi. But I remember everybody told me that it went to that concert. They stole the show from Bon Jovi.
Oh, certainly, most certainly. I was going to say they were a transition because they had the hair and they had the look, but they represented all of the decadence of LA metal scene.
Yeah,
but all of the authenticity of the punk scene. Like, these guys were real junkies. They weren't playing one on TV. Like, they'd been down the hard road, and they were singing about it, and that's what really resonated. Kind of the same with hip hop. You know, like, I've had some conversations with some friends because I've never really been a big hip hop fan, but it's always funny to me whenever you have an up and coming hip hop star who's like, he's like, I'm from the street, I'm a bad mofo, and then he sells, you know, several million records, and he's living the high life on top of the hill, and he comes out with another record. It's like, what, did you get worse? Did you go from slinging crack to now you're in designer drugs, right, at your LA parties? You're not more street than you were when you wrote your first album. You can't go deeper.
What I love is, you know, Dr. Dre. You're familiar with Dr. Dre, of course, NWA, which around 87, they had their first release, and it was a couple of years later that they had their big Straight Outta Compton album. But his original band was called the World Class Wrecking Crew. And what I love is there's a picture of Dre from when he was with World Class. This is before NWA, and he's in a skin-tight sequin bodysuit.
Yeah.
And he's posing for it and stuff. And then all of a sudden, he went gangster. So he you know, he didn't become a better person. He, quote unquote, became a gangster thug after he had been doing, you know, a song. The big hit was "Don't Turn Out the Lights," about, you know, romantic times with your lady. That was their big thing. Like, even currently, I pick on my son all the time because you listen to all these rappers and they're always talking shit about, you know, how bad they are and how tough they are, and they have all these albums and make all this money and they just become stupid. They get tattoos. They color their hair look like Skittles. But there's one guy, Bobby Shmurda, had one song that came out. It was called Hot N-Word is the name of his song. He had this huge hit, then went to jail. He's in jail right now for attempted murder. He tried to kill somebody. He really was street. He didn't bullshit on his first song. He was not bullshit. He was nothing but a thug before he made the song and during the song. And he's going to, I mean, he ended up getting sentenced for attempted murder. I want to say it was a 12-year sentence. So, yeah, he's going to be in jail for, it's going to be a while before he has another hit that comes another out. Song. But, yeah, he was the only one recently that I could think of that he didn't bullshit when he was talking crap about being a bad motherfucker and shooting people. That doesn't happen very often.
Man, I remember when Guns N' Roses came out. I was thoroughly blown away. Just absolutely starstruck. It was in my head, like, these are five of the coolest guys on the planet. Like, the way they dress, the way they act, the way they hold themselves when they're, you know, in pictures. They just look like kind of bored, but there, You know, they had the Ramon shirt and then, like, the dog collar with the padlock on it. And then, like, you know, and it's like I'm talking an amalgam of all of them. You know, I thought Axl was cool. I thought Duff was super cool. Steve was neat.
Slash was awesome.
Slash was absolutely, like, still is to this day, just elevated. Like, there's everybody on planet Earth. And then there's Slash. And he's just kind of on this pedestal. Because not just because of who he is, because I've read his biography, and I know, like, he's a cool guy. I've seen him in person, or I've seen him, you know, in interviews and stuff, and he seems like a pretty,
laid-back
cool guy. His ability with a guitar, and just the way that he's able to...
It's like he's one with the guitar.
Yes.
You can't tell where the guitar ends and begins. It's just he's...
And, amazing, I still believe that to this day. Like everybody else, and then there's Slash, you know.
And what I loved about GNR is, you know, you had your metal, you had your Metallica, because Metallica was still hard back then. They were still heavy. And then you had your hair bands. And GNR bridged that gap between the two. They found the median between the hair bands and the real heavy metal. And they bridged that gap to where they could appeal to everybody on either side of that spectrum. They were awesome, dude.
They could do the ballads, and they can do the...
The heavy shit.
The real heavy stuff. Yeah, oh yeah.
Welcome to the Jungle is just... It's one of the best rock songs ever made, dude. It's just sick.
I remember Welcome to the Jungle and Sweet Child of Mine and Paradise City. And those three videos, again, just putting those guys up on pedestals. Just as awesome as it is. And then when Patience came out, it was all laid back. And they're all chilling in that place. They're all chilling in that house. And they got that oriental rug and all of their band shit's just kind of hanging around. And they're all just kind of hanging around, smoking cigarettes. And they got girls hanging off their arms. And they're just, like, laid back and cool. It's like, so if Appetite for Destruction is, or not Appetite, but Welcome to the Jungle, if this is what defines cool, these guys are cool. Patience was like... This is what cool guys do on the weekends.
Yeah, when they want to relax.
When they're done being cool for the day, they go hang out and play acoustic guitars and like hang out with chicks and snakes and stuff. They don't wear their hat. Shit, dude, I was 11 years old. What am I gonna think? I'm just like, oh my god.
Oh, like I said, I was 14, so I was starting to go to concerts and everything at that time. I was starting to expand my horizons of music because you know up until then. I always talk to friends of mine nowadays, and they're like, yeah, I remember, you know, posters of, you know, Striper and all these other posters. The posters I remember growing up were mainly from my cousin, Pino, Death for Booty. He he had posters of Rick James. He had posters of... I grew up listening to R&B, funk, and hip-hop. And when I was 14, that's where I crossed over and started listening to... And I try to teach my kids this, too. You don't have to be so singular when it comes to music. You can enjoy all types of music. All types of music have something to offer. And I broadened my horizons at that point, and I started getting more into rock also. And GNR just happened to be that. They're the ones that bridge that gap. You know?
They really are.
Excuse me.
Well, continuing down the music path, because...
I'm sorry for that segue.
No, that's significant. Dude, that is very significant. No. And I'll talk about GNR all day. We can do a whole episode on them. But just to top line, here's a couple more stuff that just came out, and then we'll have several more to talk about. But talking about a year of kind of almost transcendent mix of artists, not necessarily their first record, but some of them their breakthrough record.
Oh, they hit a peak. They hit that peak.
So that year, INXS's Kick came out.
Another groundbreaking album.
Big record. George Michael, Faith. Before that, I mean, he was still just kind of a pretty boy singer-songwriter, but before that he was in Wham, though, kind of like the bouncy boy band. And Faith was
his own.
You know, Faith really drove that career.
And just to also segue, a lot of things that made the albums that came out this year was MTV.
Oh, for sure.
MTV was a huge thing. That's when MTV was still music videos. And you first got introduced to a lot of artists through MTV. And depending on the video and the charisma of the artist, it made a huge deal at that point. You know, you were seeing the person singing the song. And you were seeing how what their interpretation of the song was. Through videos were fucking huge back then.
And a lot of times not even having anything to do with the song. The lyrics had nothing to do with the video.
Right.
Let's see, what else do we have? Remember Buster Poindexter?
Yes,
Hot.
I loved him in Scrooge as the taxi driver.
Midnight Oil, kind of a one-hit wonder.
But still,
that's from 87.
The beds are burning.
Pink Floyd's Momentary Lapse of Reason. They had gotten rid of Roger Waters, and they were kind of moving on, doing their next thing. Couple of great songs off that record. Depeche Mode, Music for the Masses. That whole new wave had kind of hit a peak, and there was a few outstanding bands that...
Depeche Mode was one of the ones that survived.
Yeah. And Music for the Masses was one of their bigger records. Whitney Houston's Whitney record came out in 87. She had a tragic downfall, but man, she was pretty much...
She was on top of the world.
With all of these other records we're talking about, if you turn on the radio, there's about a 9 out of 10 chance you're going to hear Whitney Houston that year. Because she was just everywhere.
Yep.
Springsteen's Tunnel of Love, which was a big record. All right, let's see. Where else? Okay, Mallrats, Tiffany, and Debbie Gibson. They were
Who was hotter? In your opinion.
I'd have to give it to Tiffany.
Me too. Thank you. High five. I agree with you on that one.
I thought Debbie Gibson was cute. Tiffany was definitely sexier.
She was hot. Yeah.
Again, we're 40s. We're talking about like 17.
I was 14 years. At the time.
So yeah, I was 11. So it's okay.
Is Helix on there anywhere? This is just a joke. I heard a Helix interview on a podcast a little while ago. And it just...
Let's see here.
Do you remember Helix at all? Canadian rock band? They had a song called The Big Hit Was Rock You. Give me a R O C K. What's the spell? Rock. What do you want to do? Rock you. Sounds they toured like, with Scorpions. They toured with Motorhead. They toured with a whole bunch of bands, but they were a big Canadian rock band back in the day.
There's a lot of stuff that I missed because I was too busy listening to Guns N' Roses.
We'll close it out with Helix Rock You.
So. Still, okay, just keep on running down the line. Not necessarily bands that we really necessarily like, but that just made an impact.
Significant and, releases.
You know, REM's Document came out.
Yep.
New Order's Substance came out. New Order was reformed after Ian Astbury from Joy Division killed himself. And
now, REM's big album was in the early 90s, right? That was
a Document was... Yeah, that
the real big one that really brought them mainstream was not early 90s.
Yes, that was early 90s. Document was their first
their
breakthrough record. New Order Substance, a little record called Bad by Michael Jackson came out, which was later lampooned by Weird Al.
Fat. You ever watch those videos like back to back?
They're like similar. They're very similar. What's funny is I saw a meme the other day that was saying it's like most of the people that Weird Al lampooned are no longer relevant, but he still is. Like he just managed to stay on ahead of the wave.
My son was a huge fan of his growing up because I introduced my son to all Weird Al's music. What's his name? Brian, the comedian, Brian Povich. What's his name? Damn it. Big tall guy. He was on he used to do appearances on Big Bang Theory and a few other shows.
Oh, the big guy with the glasses?
Yeah, with the glasses and the beard.
Yeah.
He has great... Yeah, I don't know if you ever listened to his stand-up, but his stand-up's awesome. But one of his stand-ups was... He said, I'm going to raise my son only listening to Weird Al songs so that one day he's in high school and he calls me from a party and he just got listening to Michael Jackson's Bad, and he calls me and says, can you believe somebody remade Weird Al's song and called it Bad? I just thought that was awesome.
That's a good idea.
Just only play Weird Al songs for them, so when they hear the actual music, they think somebody stole Weird Al shit.
Oh, man. We're running down the line here. Probably one of the biggest records of 87 was Def Leppard's Hysteria.
You know me and Def Leppard. I've seen them several times. I've met them more than once. They Hysteria was huge, dude.
Honestly, it was Guns N' Roses that knocked me off of the Def Leppard loving.
Def Leppard was another one of those bands, though, that was in between hair metal and heavy metal. They kind of bridged that gap also. They weren't totally hair metal. They weren't pretty boy hair metal band, but they kind of... That's why they were so successful as arena rock band, because they appealed to so many different people.
Well, Def Leppard was part of the... new wave of British heavy metal. They kind of started and came up around the same time as bands like Iron Maiden, Venom, those guys. Def Leppard had a little bit more star appeal, and Def Leppard was also very young. They, like, with all the bands, like all of their peers in that same sort of British, they're all a little bit older guys. Def Leppard was all like 16, 17 years old. And they looked good, and they got signed, and they, you know, they. But what made Def Leppard was Mutt Lange, and the producer, and he produced Pyromania, and he produced Hysteria, and really kind of toned them down from heavy metal to more kind of power ballad and anthem-y.
Right.
So he turned them into an arena band. Which Iron Maiden is an arena band too, but Iron Maiden's lights are red.
Yeah,
like they're a darker, heavier, more angry feel. Whereas Def Leppard's in it for the girls, sort of, you know. And when you can appeal to the girls, then you can sell records.
Right. And just so you know, if you ever check out the documentary or the concert film "Viva Hysteria," which is Def Leppard's their performance in Las Vegas during their backstage performance of Two Steps, you can see me for about 5 seconds.
Nice.
Because I'm backstage with a group of people singing the song with them. So
killer.
Just so you know.
Same year, Garage Days Revisited.
Dude, that album introduced me to Metallica, because like I said, that was the year I kind of bridged over. And dude, I got something to say. I killed your baby today. That song blew my mind, dude. It was
that was a Misfits song too.
Yeah, but just Metallica was just that was my introduction to Metallica. And
so I'm gonna give you a trigger warning if you get weirded out by racist things, because this is gonna be my little semi-racist thing. I went to school in Portland, Texas, which was a pretty equal split between white and Hispanic. We had one black kid in the school, and his name was Michael Jackson. Of you know, but I digress. For those of you who don't know, Mexicans love heavy metal.
Love them too.
Love it. Like bands that were no longer relevant in the early 90s, early to mid 90s, 80s bands that were no longer relevant in the States were making massive amounts of money in Mexico by touring Mexico, because Mexicans just love like heavy metal, hair metal.
And just to add to that, it wasn't just Mexico, South America also.
Right.
Metal bands are fucking huge, dude.
Well, and the reason I'm mentioning this is because we had a very high Hispanic bunch of kids in our school, you know. It was like, you know, I was 11. So, you know, like late elementary, when you're in like late elementary school, there's all of the kids with bowl cuts and striped polos with maybe an alligator on it. And then you got those two Mexican brothers who have long hair and Metallica and Megadeth t-shirts on. It's like those guys are scary. You know, like, then come to find out later, those guys are right. Those guys are right. Those guys are listening to this shit because their older brother does.
Right.
And I wouldn't figure that shit out for another, like, 8 years. But those guys were right. So I have to reach out and say, guys, sorry, man. Like, I thought y'all were scary, but I turned into you. you guys had it.
And just so you know, one of the reasons I mentioned South America, Kiss first performed without makeup in, I believe it was Sao Paulo, Brazil. The opening act for that concert, Helix.
Oh, nice.
I just learned that on the podcast I just listened to, that Helix was the opening band.
Should
the
I look up the Helix song and play it just for the...
Rock you. That's the song you want to play, I'm telling you.
I'm going to write that shit down.
They've been around since 1974.
Dude, I probably heard it. There's a lot of beer in this brain. There's a lot of dead brain cells.
There's a lot of great music to take in.
But yeah, like I said, just being 11 years old and seeing those two guys and just being like, you know. they were scary. They were scary looking kids. They're my age, but you're just like, whoa, they listen to all that devil music. I'm over here listening to Def Leppard.
It's a country music.
It's just a little while later before Guns N' Roses would come and knock them right off the charts. And but yeah, for the biggest records, I mean, Girls, Girls, Girls from Motley Crue came out. That was a game changer. Faith No More, Introduce Yourself came out. That was their first record.
Record, right. And their big one was early 90s also, Faith No More.
Their best record was Angel Dust.
Yeah.
It came out in like 92.
92, yep. Yep.
And then the album Kiss Me, Kiss Me, Kiss Me by The Cure, which, you know, you'd be like, wow, you threw Guns N' Roses up there before you did The Cure. But, dude, seriously, that was a game changer for a lot of folks. That record changed a lot of hearts and minds as far as, you know, moving into pop music,
yeah,
moving into the 90s, that had Just Like Heaven on it. There's a lot of weird stuff on there that got you kind of out of the mainstream and started looking differently. And then Jane's Addiction's first record.
Ooh. I love the Jane's Addiction, dude.
87. We could easily do just part three on movies.
That's what I was thinking. We'll just do part three. We'll do old business, new business, and knock out the rest of the movies from 1987. Because, you know, once we get into movies, we're going to have even more segues where we expand on things. And...
All right. Well, with that, you're about to hear some Helix. Keep it scary, guys.
Later.
Loneliness.
Why?